We truly have to look deeply into our own hearts if we want to experience the fruits of this practice. Attempting to describe the psychology of the mind in terms of the numerous separate moments of consciousness and their different characteristics is, in my opinion, not taking the practice far enough. There's still a lot more to it. If we're going to study these things, then know them absolutely, with clarity and penetrative understanding. Without clarity of insight, how will we ever be finished with them? There's no end to it. We'll never complete our studies. Practicing Dharma is thus extremely important. When I practiced, that's how I studied. I didn't know anything about mind moments or psychological factors. I just observed the quality of knowing. If a thought of hate arose, I asked myself why. If a thought of love arose, I asked myself why. This is the way. Whether it's labelled as a thought or called a psychological factor, so what? Just penetrate this one point until you're able to resolve these feelings of love and hate, until they completely vanish from the heart. When I was able to stop loving and hating under any circumstance, I was able to transcend suffering. Then it doesn't matter what happens. The heart and mind are released and at ease. Nothing remains. It has all stopped. Practice like this. If people want to talk a lot about theory, that's their business. But no matter how much it's debated, the practice always comes down to this single point right here. When something arises, it arises right here. Whether a lot or a little, it originates right here. When it ceases, the cessation is right here. Where else? The Buddha called this point the knowing. When it knows the way things are accurately, in line with the truth, we'll understand the meaning of mind. Things incessantly deceive. As you study them, they're simultaneously deceiving you. How else can I put it? Even though you know about them, you are still being deluded by them, precisely where you know them. That's the situation. The issue is this. It's my opinion that the Buddha didn't intend that we only know what these things are called. The aim of the Buddha's teachings is to figure out the way to liberate ourselves from these things through searching for the underlying causes. I practiced Dharma without knowing a great deal. I just knew that the path to liberation began with virtue, sila. Virtue is the beautiful beginning of the path. The deep peace of samadhi is the beautiful middle. Wisdom, punya, is the beautiful end. Although they can be separated as three unique aspects of the training, as we look into them more and more deeply, these three qualities converge as one. To uphold virtue, you have to be wise. We usually advise people to develop ethical standards first by keeping the five precepts so that their virtue will become solid. However, the perfection of virtue takes a lot of wisdom. We have to consider our speech and actions and analyze their consequences. This is all the work of wisdom. We have to rely on our wisdom in order to cultivate virtue. According to the theory, virtue comes first, then samadhi, and then wisdom. But when I examined it, I found that wisdom is the foundation stone for every other aspect of the practice. In order to fully comprehend the consequences of what we say and do, especially the harmful consequences, we need to use wisdom to guide and supervise, to scrutinize the workings of cause and effect. This will purify our actions and speech. Once we become familiar with ethical and unethical behavior, we see the place to practice. We then abandon what's bad and cultivate what's good. We abandon what's wrong and cultivate what's right. This is virtue. As we do this, the heart becomes increasingly firm and steadfast. A steadfast and unwavering heart is free of apprehension, remorse, and confusion concerning our actions and speech. This is samadhi. This stable unification of mind forms a secondary and more powerful source of energy in our Dharma practice, allowing a deeper contemplation of the sights, sounds, etc. that we experience. Once the mind is established with firm and unwavering mindfulness and peace, we can engage in sustained inquiry into the reality of the body, feeling, perception, thought, consciousness, sights, sounds, and so on. As they continually arise, we continue to investigate with a sincere determination not to lose our mindfulness. Then we'll know what these things actually are. They come into existence following their own natural truth. As our understanding steadily grows, wisdom is born. Once there's clear comprehension of the way things truly are, our old perceptions are uprooted, and our conceptual knowledge transforms into wisdom. That's how virtue, samadhi, and wisdom merge and function as one. The framework for Dharma practice is the Four Noble Truths: suffering, dukkha, the origin of suffering, samudaya, the cessation of suffering, nirodha, and the path leading to the cessation of suffering, magga. This path consists of virtue, samadhi, and wisdom, the framework for training the heart. Their true meaning is not to be found in these words, but dwells in the depth of our hearts. That's what virtue, samadhi, and wisdom are like. They revolve continually. The Noble Eightfold Path will envelop any sight, sound, smell, taste, bodily sensation, or object of mind that arises. However, if the factors of the Eightfold Path are weak and timid, the defilements will possess our minds. If the Noble Path is strong and courageous, it will conquer and destroy the defilements. If we focus our endeavour on developing the way of Dharma, defilements will be gradually and persistently eradicated. Once fully cultivated, the Four Noble Truths reside in our hearts. In whatever form suffering takes, it always exists due to a cause. That's the second noble truth. And what is the cause? Weak virtue, weak samadhi, weak wisdom. The conditions which give rise to the path are virtue, samadhi, and wisdom. When they have attained full strength, the path of Dharma is unstoppable, advancing unceasingly to overcome the attachment and clinging that brings us so much anguish. Suffering can't arise because the path is destroying the defilements. It's at this point that the cessation of suffering occurs. Why is the path able to bring about the cessation of suffering? Because virtue, samadhi, and wisdom are attaining their peak of perfection, and the path has gathered an unstoppable momentum. It all comes together right here. I would say to anyone who practices like this, theoretical ideas about the mind don't come into the picture. If the mind has transcended conceptual knowledge, it will be very confident and certain in the practice, having gone beyond all doubt. Even if it starts to wander off, you won't have to chase it very far to bring it back onto the path. Virtue, samadhi, and wisdom constitute the path of the Buddha. But the way is not the essence of the Dharma. The path isn't an end in itself, not the ultimate aim of the Blessed One. But it's the way leading inwards. It's just like how you travelled from Bangkok to my monastery, Wat Nong Papong. It's not the road you were after, What you wanted was to reach the monastery, but you needed the road for the journey. The road you travelled on is not the monastery. It's just the way to get here. But if you want to arrive at the monastery, you have to follow the road. It's the same with virtue, samadhi, and wisdom. We could say they are not the essence of the Dharma, but they are the road to arrive there. When virtue, samadhi, and wisdom have been mastered, the result is profound peace of mind. That's the destination. Once we've arrived at this peace, even if we hear a noise, the mind remains unruffled. Once we've reached this peace, there's nothing remaining to do. The Buddha taught to give it all up. Whatever happens, there's nothing to worry about. Then we truly, unquestionably, know for ourselves. We no longer simply believe what other people say. The essential principle of Buddhism is empty of any phenomena. It's not contingent upon miraculous displays of psychic powers, paranormal abilities, or anything else mystical or bizarre. The Buddha did not emphasize the importance of these things. Such powers, however, do exist and may be possible to develop. But this facet of Dharma is deluding, so the Buddha did not advocate or encourage it. The only people he praised were the ones who were able to liberate themselves from suffering. To accomplish this requires training, and the tools and equipment to get the job done are generosity, virtue, samadhi, and wisdom. We have to take them up and train with them. Together they form a path inclining inwards, and wisdom is the first step. Using the tools of practice entails hardship and arduous challenges. We rely on patience, endurance, and going without. We have to do it ourselves, experience it for ourselves, realize it ourselves. Scholars, however, tend to get confused a lot. For example, when they sit in meditation, as soon as their minds experience a teeny bit of tranquility, they start to think, "Hey, this must be first jhana." This is how their minds work. And once those thoughts arise, the tranquility they'd experienced is shattered. Soon they start to think that it must have been the second jhana they'd attained. Don't think and speculate about it. There aren't any billboards which announce which level of samadhi we're experiencing. The reality is completely different. There aren't any signs like the road signs that tell you this way to Wat Nong Papong. That's not how I read the mind. It doesn't announce. Although a number of highly esteemed scholars have written descriptions of the first, second, third, and fourth jhanas, what's written is merely external information. if the mind actually enters these states of profound peace, it doesn't know anything about those written descriptions. It knows, but what it knows isn't the same as the theory we study. If the scholars try to clutch their theory and drag it into their meditation, sitting and pondering, what could this be? Is this first jhana yet? There, the peace is shattered, and they don't experience anything of real value. And why is that? Because there is desire, and once there's craving, what happens? The mind is simultaneously withdrawn out of the meditation. So it's necessary for all of us to relinquish thinking and speculation. Abandon them completely. Just take up the body, speech, and mind and delve entirely into the practice. Observe the workings of the mind, but don't lug the Dharma books in there with you. Otherwise, everything becomes a big mess, because nothing in those books corresponds precisely to the reality of the way things truly are. People who study a lot, who are full of theoretical knowledge, usually don't succeed in Dharma practice. They get bogged down at the information level. The truth is, the heart and mind can't be measured by external standards. If the mind is getting peaceful, just allow it to be peaceful. The most profound levels of deep peace do exist. Personally, I didn't know much about the theory of practice. I'd been a monk for 3 years and still had a lot of questions about what samadhi actually was. I kept trying to think about it and figure it out as I meditated. But my mind became even more restless and distracted than it had before. The amount of thinking actually increased. When I wasn't meditating, it was more peaceful. Boy, was it difficult, so exasperating. But even though I encountered so many obstacles, I never threw in the towel. I just kept on doing it. When I wasn't trying to do anything in particular, my mind was relatively at ease. But whenever I determined to make the mind unify in samadhi, it went out of control. What's going on here? I wondered. Why is this happening? Later on, I began to realize that meditation was comparable to the process of breathing. If we're determined to force the breath to be shallow, deep, or just right, it's very difficult to do. However, if we go for a stroll and we're not even aware of when we're breathing in or out, it's extremely relaxing. So I reflected, aha, maybe that's the way it works. When a person is normally walking around in the course of the day, not focusing attention on their breath, does their breathing cause them suffering? No, they just feel relaxed. But when I'd sit down and vow with determination that I was going to make my mind peaceful, clinging and attachment set in. When I tried to control the breath to be shallow or deep, it just brought on more stress than it had before. Why? Because the willpower I was using was tainted with clinging and attachment. I didn't know what was going on. All that frustration and hardship was coming up because I was bringing craving into the meditation.